Welcome to the Collaborative Psychiatry Podcast, where we help busy primary care providers build confidence in managing mental health. I'm Dr. Daniel Suter, a psychiatrist trained in general and addiction psychiatry and currently working in collaborative and integrated care. I created this platform to make psychiatric education simple, practical, and genuinely useful for real-world medicine. Thanks to the support of our subscribers, this podcast remains completely free of commercial influence. Everything you hear reflects my own clinical experience and interpretation of the literature, no sponsorships or outside agendas. If you want to learn more about our mission, visit us at collaborative-psychiatry.org. We've got in-depth courses, clinical tools, and lots of other subscriber resources. This episode is part of our audio quick take series, which are 15 to 20 minute episodes designed to give you high yield, evidence-based tools that you can start using right away in clinic. If you're interested in more in-depth learning, check out our first full-length CME course on managing depression in primary care through our website. It's about an hour and a half long and covers everything from diagnosis to med selection, augmentation approaches, ketamine, and more. If you find this quick take helpful, please don't forget to subscribe or leave a review, and check out our website for downloadable clinical tools and resources that will help you put the information you learn here into practice with your patients. Let's get into it. So today we're going to talk a little bit about a massive topic, which is ADHD in adults and how to think about approaching this diagnosis in primary care. This topic is honestly far too large to cover fully in 15 or 20 minutes, but we will have lots of material on this topic coming down the pipeline. We'll have a short podcast coming out later this season that will provide you with a framework for how to think about stimulant medications. And we have two full-length courses in the works, one on stimulants themselves and one that's focused more on diagnosing and managing ADHD in primary care. But today, I really want to discuss how to think conceptually about all these patients coming in reporting difficulties with focus and attention and concerns that they might have ADHD. Are they right? Are they wrong? What are the other factors to consider, etc.? Our learning objectives today are as follows. By the end of this episode, you should be able to 1. Recognize the sociocultural and environmental trends contributing to increased self-reported attentional difficulties in adults. 2. Describe key clinical considerations that may suggest a diagnosis of ADHD versus other contributing factors. And 3. Outline a basic approach for initiating an ADHD assessment in primary care, including the use of the ASRS and Wender-Utah screening tools. Okay, so no one these days can deny that we're in a sort of mental health awakening, quote unquote. Everyone's talking more about their depression, their anxiety, trauma, ADHD, autism, you name it. There are whole communities out there on social media focused on these topics, right? And providing guidance around diagnosis, how to talk to your doctor about treatment, etc. In many ways, this is a huge win for movements to destigmatize mental health. We can now talk about these issues more or less openly, and the barriers to treatment have never been lower. On the other hand, I think the same trend has resulted in a lot of self-diagnosis and colloquialization of terminology that would not necessarily hold up clinically. ADHD is one of the diagnoses that's vulnerable to this trend. At least 1 in 16 adults report a current ADHD diagnosis, half of them only since adulthood. Many of these are real and impairing. And of those adult-specific diagnoses, I'm sure that the majority simply weren't diagnosed when they were children. But I also do think that ADHD is relatively easy to misdiagnose in our current times, and there are a lot of reasons for that. And that's one of the topics I want to touch on today. So one thing that I think is worthwhile clearing up at the beginning here is this concept of adult-onset ADHD. This is new ADHD in someone who had no issues with it as a child. The literature is still out on whether or not this is an actual phenomenon in a very small number of people, but what we have been able to study seems to show that at least 93 to 95% of supposed adult onset ADHD symptoms actually reflect other issues, whether that's mood issues, insomnia, or simply an individual's environmental demands exceeding their executive functioning capabilities, as opposed to new ADHD starting in adulthood. I may be biased here, but my opinion is that the more we study causes of inattention or difficulties focusing, the more we're going to turn away from this idea of adult onset ADHD. In any case, this is a complicated enough area that I think from a PCP perspective, if someone is reporting that they had a normal childhood and only developed symptoms after they became an adult, it's safe to say that they don't have ADHD. Or at very least, right, that they would need more specialized testing or evaluations to land at a diagnosis. Now, the next question is, why are there so many adults coming in these days with complaints related to their attention and ability to focus or be productive? And as with everything, I think the answer is multifaceted. As we've discussed, there are social media trends towards self-diagnosis that are certainly playing a role. There's also what I think of as the playing catch-up phenomenon, where people who weren't diagnosed as children due to a lack of awareness of ADHD back then are now recognizing legitimate symptoms of the disorder in themselves. The other piece of the puzzle that I think is important is the fact that we simply live in a more distracted world these days. There's so much information vying for our attention that it feels overwhelming at times. We've got social media algorithms that have been shown to activate our reward pathways in the same ways that many substances of abuse do, drawing us back in whenever our mind wanders naturally away from our current task. We've got devices in our pockets that chirp at us every few minutes with a new notification, actively drawing our attention away from whatever we're involved in at the time. Some studies have reported that it can take upwards of 20 minutes after a distraction to fully refocus on the task at hand. And when they've studied notification use in college students, they found that turning off notifications reduces self-reported inattentive and hyperactivity symptoms compared with having them on, and that the sense of well-being increases while they're off. At a cultural level, then, technology is actually atrophying our attention span the same way that muscles atrophy during a prolonged hospitalization through lack of use. If you pair that phenomenon with an increasingly competitive job and educational environment, it seems like a recipe for subjective complaints related to attention and ability to focus. On top of all that, we then have the fact that the medications for ADHD are essentially performance enhancers, and they're some of the most widely shared medications across the US. Non-prescribed stimulant use is a huge issue in colleges and graduate schools, including medical training, by the way. And it's an issue because they work. You don't have to have ADHD to take a stimulant and be able to focus more intently on a task that might otherwise have bored you. So people are familiar with these medications now, and sometimes they'll come in reporting symptoms of ADHD simply in order to obtain a script for performance-enhancing reasons. Okay, so that's a lot, right? There's a sort of perfect storm of circumstances that I think really helps to explain why so many adults these days are coming in with complaints related to their attention or ability to focus. We have technology wearing away at our collective focus, social media making these diagnoses trendy and leading to self-diagnosis, an increasingly competitive job and education market that has raised demands on people's productivity, and familiarity with stimulants as a potential solution to that demand. Now, that's a lot of noise to superimpose on all those individuals who do have real ADHD and are just coming in looking for real help. So obviously, the next question that comes up is how to differentiate real ADHD from any of those other phenomena. Now, we'll get into the nuances around diagnosis in our full-length course on managing ADHD, but I think it's helpful to discuss a few core facets here to aid in a conceptual understanding of how to approach these patients. First of all, I think it's important to establish that ADHD is ultimately a clinical diagnosis. Neuropsychiatric testing is often thought of as being the gold standard for ADHD diagnosis. However, it's not ultimately designed to provide a specific diagnosis. It can provide a very important data point that can be part of a diagnosis, but ultimately, the diagnosis comes from a clinician who makes the call. This is helpful to know, I think, because neuropsych testing itself can be incredibly difficult to access. It's often not covered by insurance, and due to the depth of testing involved, typically lasts anywhere from 2 to 6 hours, sometimes spaced out over 2 visits. For most patients in need of treatment for ADHD, it's not easily available. When it comes to the clinical diagnosis itself, We're typically not talking about screening all patients in order to find incidental diagnoses of ADHD as we might do with depression or anxiety, right? Instead, we have patients coming in with subjective complaints, and the onus ends up being on us as sort of gatekeepers to determine whether it seems consistent with a real diagnosis. Speaking to the point we made earlier, I think the first historical detail that I would explore before considering a diagnosis of ADHD is whether there's a lifelong history of symptoms. If they had no related symptoms as a child before the age of 12, as per the DSM, then I think the weight of evidence is strongly against the possibility of new adult onset ADHD. And it's fair to tell those folks that you don't think they have ADHD, or they need to go get more specialized testing. You can find help in some of the screeners out there. The two that I think are most suited for primary care are the ADHD Self-Report Scale, or ASRS, and the Wender-Utah ADHD Rating Scale, or WERS. We'll talk more about each of these in our full-length course on ADHD management, but the ASRS screens based off of current symptoms, and the Wender-Utah screens based off of childhood symptoms. So together, I think they can provide some really useful cues towards a diagnosis or away from one. You can access copies of both of them through our website. The other thing to think about is that ADHD is not an urgent diagnosis, right? Even if the patient may present it as such. If someone's coming in with these concerns, I think it's totally reasonable to give yourself some time and maybe even space out the process between two appointments. At the first appointment, they bring up their concerns, you take some history, give them the ASRS and Wender-Utah to take home and fill out, and then you schedule a follow-up where they will bring the screener back and you can do a deeper dive on the symptoms based off the screeners and see if it's possible at that point to arrive at a diagnosis. Okay, that wraps up today's episode. Again, we've only touched the surface here and we've got a lot more coming on this topic, including our next quick take episode in 2 weeks, which will be on how to choose and titrate stimulants in adults, as well as a full-length audio course on stimulants, which will be dropping at the end of this quick take season, and then more coming after that. But to quickly recap this episode before we close, we discussed that we're seeing more adults presenting with attentional complaints, often influenced by a mix of cultural shifts, technology, and real diagnostic gaps from childhood. It's important to keep in mind that not all inattention is ADHD, and exploring a patient's early history, using tools like the ASRS and Wender-Utah, and giving yourself space to assess over time can go a long way in making thoughtful decisions. You don't need to make the call in one visit, but having a framework for how to start can make this feel a lot more manageable. That's it for today's episode. Thanks so much for listening. Don't forget to check out the downloadable companion resources for this episode available on our website at collaborative-psychiatry.org/quicktakes. There are detailed show notes, as well as a handout providing an overview of this topic. We've got a table reviewing the differential for attentional complaints, and we've got patient handouts explaining A, why someone might feel unfocused even without ADHD, and B, some practical tools that they can use to improve focus, regardless of diagnosis or meds. Now, if this episode made your work a little bit easier, please consider sharing it with a colleague or leaving a quick review on whatever podcast app you use most frequently. It really helps us reach more providers and spread this information more widely. And now our disclaimer. The content in this podcast is intended for general educational purposes only, and does not constitute the practice of medicine or the establishment of a professional relationship. The use of the information in this podcast in clinical practice is at your own discretion and risk. Thanks again for joining us today, and see you in 2 weeks for our next episode on stimulants in primary care.